edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Batakhwa and the entire team, this is goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana awwalul muslimin.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. Russia slams the European signatories that urge JCPOA for their unconstructive approach and opposes any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the accord. Rights groups are calling for accountability after a U.S. decision not to punish forces involved in a drone strike that killed Afghan children. Also in the headlines, the World Health Organization warns Omicron is spreading at an unprecedented rate, urging countries to raise their shields. Welcome to the program. Moscow says the stances of the European parties to the 2015 deal with Iran and the ongoing Vienna talks are surprising, unconstructive, and somewhat illogical, as if they were sitting at a negotiating table for the first time. Russia's representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Mikhail Ulyanov, has made the remarks in an interview with Iran's Russian language Pars Today. He believes that the Vienna talks are moving ahead slowly, with high chances of having a positive outcome. The Russian representative said the Iranian delegation is very serious with clear demands. He also praised Iran's draft proposals as a step forward. Ulyanov said Moscow is opposed to any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal. According to Ulyanov, there are major obstacles to getting a guarantee from the U.S. that it will not withdraw from the deal again. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the discussions with the International Atomic Energy Agency have made progress. Said Khatibzadeh says talks between head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, and IAEA chief Rafael Grossi have narrowed gaps over several issues of mutual interest. Khatibzadeh says the two sides are expected to reach an understanding soon. The IAEA has been asking for access to a nuclear site that came under a sabotage attack in June. That is the centrifuge component manufacturing workshop at the Tessa Karaj complex. Iran says it'll give the agency access to the site only if all the other parties to the 2015 agreement fulfill their obligations. Rights groups are slamming the U.S. decision not to punish staff involved in a botched airstrike that killed civilians in Afghanistan. The American Civil Liberties Union says it's disappointed over the outcome of the Pentagon's investigation into the late August drone strike. Aid group Nutrition and Education International says such decisions send a dangerous message that the deadly attack was justified. Advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow is calling for an international investigation, noting that the United States cannot hold itself accountable. The Pentagon says its probe found no violation of the law. Washington has called the drone strike a tragic mistake. It says the civilian target was mistaken for a Daesh terrorist preparing to attack U.S. forces and diplomats. The strike killed 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. Earlier I asked political commentator Sarah Flounders to comment on the issue. She said the international community must hold Washington accountable for the crimes U.S. troops committed in Afghanistan.
This is U.S. policy, thousands and thousands of drone attacks. And again, it's been exposed as overwhelmingly attacks on civilians. And the response of the U.S. has been to jail anyone who has exposed these crimes. In Afghanistan, because by then U.S. troops were on their way out the door, they couldn't suppress the story. But it's not the first time it's come up. As Daniel Hale, who's now serving 4 years in prison, exposed thousands of drone attacks. We know that the U.S. is unaccountable, even though they directly, with a drone attack, assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, an Iranian major general on a peace mission to Iraq a year ago this month. So U.S. crimes, particularly with drone warfare, continues unrelenting. There's no accountability ever in these attacks. The one in Afghanistan was just horrendous. So there should be a demand for accountability. There should be charges of war crimes for the firing of these Hellfire missiles at the press of a button. But we shouldn't expect that the United States will ever respond to these acts that they are so criminally have carried out.
The United Arab Emirates says it will withdraw from talks to acquire billions of dollars worth of advanced U.S. weaponry. Abu Dhabi says it has made the decision due to technical requirements and sovereign operational restrictions. This means that the UAE will no longer be receiving the 50 F-35 fighter jets and nearly 20 armed drones it was hoping to acquire. Washington says it is still committed to the sales of the aircraft to the Arab country. Abu Dhabi's decision comes amid disagreements with Washington over its relationship with China. It also comes days after the UAE struck a multi-billion dollar agreement with France for the purchase of 80 Rafale warplanes. The United Arab Emirates' reception of the Israeli Prime Minister has been met with anger. Palestinians say Abu Dhabi is betraying their cause by normalizing its relations with the regime. They're also calling for the expulsion of the UAE from the Arab League. Iran has also condemned the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to the UAE as detrimental to regional security.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli Prime Minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE. They don't care about the people of Palestine, and they don't care about the Arab. They certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel.
The UAE claims the normalization will enable it to mediate between the Israelis and the Palestinians, but that hasn't been helpful at all considering Israel's 11-day deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip in May, which happened months after Tel Aviv normalized ties with Abu Dhabi. Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians on an almost daily basis also raise questions about the real intentions behind the normalization. Take a look.
The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ibrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria, almost. And they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as a root cause of problems in the region.
So now all of this is U.S. policy, and it's going to continue to be U.S. policy. And that's why their vassal states in the Middle East, these Arab monarchies that have no authority, really, to rule except by because of European colonialism and Western imperialism, they do what they're told.
Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
The United States hits a grim milestone in its fight against the COVID pandemic, the number of deaths in the country now passing the 800,000 mark. The data from the Johns Hopkins University represents the highest reported toll of any country in the world. Most deaths have been recorded among the unvaccinated and the elderly. The U.S. reached 50 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 2 days ago. The alarming surge in deaths comes as the world is bracing for a rise in cases of the new Omicron variant, with the World Health Organization warning that it's spreading at an unprecedented rate.
77 countries have now reported cases of Omicron, and the reality is that Omicron is probably in most countries, even if it hasn't been detected yet. Omicron is spreading at a rate we have not seen with any previous variant.
The WHO chief said many countries are rolling out their booster shots, warning of a repeat of vaccine hoarding and inequity. Noted that there are many people who have not received a single jab yet. Omicron was first detected in November. It has a large number of mutations. A preliminary study by South African scientists suggests Omicron is highly transmissible and may evade immunity from vaccination. In other news, nearly 100 of Britain's conservative lawmakers have voted against Prime Minister Boris Johnson's proposed coronavirus restrictions. Also, 17 other Tory parliamentarians abstained. A revolt means further trouble for Johnson, who's under immense pressure due to a number of scandals. Earlier this month, the Labour Party accused the Premier of taking Britons for fool over a Christmas party held in Downing Street in breach of lockdown restrictions. The British Premier also faced heavy backlash in May over the expensive refurbishment of his official residence. A study has found the name of Islam's Prophet Muhammad is the most popular one for boys in the UK. Islam has long been described as the fastest growing religion in the world. However, its rise has also been marked with a rise in Islamophobia. Yet, parents continue to use the beloved name. Robert Carter is in London.
Mohammed once again tops the list for the most popular boy's name for newborns in the UK. According to parenting website Baby Centre, the name of Islam's holy prophet was the most popular name for boys in 2021, meaning the beloved Muslim name has held the top spot for the fifth year in a row.
Sadly, British Muslims are living in an era of growing Islamophobia, and simply having a Muslim-sounding name could inspire discrimination. However, despite this, the name remains as popular as ever, and it's growing year upon year.
So why do so many Muslim parents want to name their sons Mohammed? I asked a community leader to find out more.
When we pronounce the name of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, it is a full of barakah. And if you see the meaning of Muhammad literally, it means the you can say praise again praise. Who, the person who is praised and whose praise is not coming to an end. So Muslims love their Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Hence they keep the name of their children Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And also there is many reward. If a person has the name Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the day of, you can say, judgment, God will say, you will enter paradise. He is not only for the Muslim. He is the mercy for the mankind. He is the, you can say, light for each and everyone. So this is our duty. I would like to request to our, you can say, people, those they are not aware about it, they must study.
Baby Center said the name also tops the website's most popular boy's name for the entire decade, while other high-ranking baby names for boys and girls in 2021 with Muslim connections include Fatima, Ali, and Layla, further cementing the theory that Islam could become the most successful religion in the Western world in the not-too-distant future. Robert Carter, London.
Iran has held an exhibition of domestically made machinery and equipment dubbed Made in Iran. The expo seeks to support domestic producers in the wake of the U.S. sanctions that prevent Iranian industries from accessing foreign technologies. Youssef Jalali has filed a report.
Made in Iran. This label is tagged on all of the 9,000 products showcased here in this exhibition that has the same title, Made in Iran. It's the ninth edition of the annual tech event that brings Iranian local producers under one roof in Tehran to promote their products. The products cover 14 industrial sectors, including oil and petrochemical industries, electricity, agriculture, and health. In addition to acting as an advertising platform for the participating companies, the expo is a hot marketplace where manufacturers can sell their products on the spot. In fact, it's a win-win deal for both customers and producers, because any product is sold with as much as 50% discount funded by Iran's Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, with the aim of supporting domestic production. Since the U.S.'s withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the new Iranian government still believes in diplomacy, it says it will not tie the economy to the 2015 deal, and instead, it lends more support to domestic production.
Domestic production, as put by local brands here, will be the key to a resilient economy in Iran and a counterforce to U.S. sanctions that prevent Iranian industries from accessing foreign technology. Now it seems that the sanctions have given domestic production a boost here as the government seeks to drive the economy with Made in Iran products. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The House of Representatives Committee laid out its case for a contempt of Congress charge against Mark Meadows, the chief of staff of former President Donald J. Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Emily Cochrane. The piece is titled, "Meadows Was Deeply Involved in Fighting Election Outcome," January 6th panel says. The House committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol released a report on Sunday, 12th of December, that laid out its case for a contempt of Congress charge against Mark Meadows, the chief of staff to former President Donald J. Trump, presenting evidence of Mr. Meadows' deep involvement in the effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. In the 51-page document, the House committee said it wanted to question Mark Meadows about an email he had sent a day before the attack, advising that the National Guard would be used to defend Trump supporters. The House panel said it also wants to ask him about an exchange with an unnamed senator about rejecting electors for Joseph R. Biden Jr. Mark Meadows had been cooperating with the committee's investigation, but he refused to appear for a scheduled deposition last week or to turn over additional documents, citing Donald Trump's assertion of executive privilege. The House committee, which is controlled by Democrats, is slated to vote on Monday to recommend a contempt of Congress charge against him for his refusal to cooperate with its subpoena. That charge carries a penalty of up to a year in jail. Before coming to loggerheads with the House panel, Mark Meadows provided more than 9,000 pages of records to the committee. The information they contained raised additional questions, the panel said. Among the emails and text messages that Mark Meadows turned over were the following, the House panel said. A 7th of November email that discussed an attempt to arrange with state legislators to appoint slates of pro-Trump electors instead of the Biden electors chosen by the voters. Mr. Meadows' text messages also showed him asking members of Congress how to put Donald Trump in contact with slate legislators. Text messages Mark Meadows exchanged with an unidentified senator in which he recounted Donald Trump's view on Vice President Mike Pence's ability to reject electors from certain states. Donald Trump thinks the legislators have the power, but the vice president has power too, Mr. Meadows wrote. A 5th of January email in which Mark Meadows said the National Guard would be present at the Capitol on 6th of January to protect pro-Trump people. Emails from Mr. Meadows to Justice Department officials on 29th of December, 30th of December, and 1st of January, in which he encouraged investigators of voter fraud, including allegations already rejected by federal investigators and by courts of law. Text messages Mark Meadows exchanged with members of Congress as violence engulfed the Capitol on 6th of January, in which lawmakers encouraged him to persuade Donald Trump to discourage the attack, as well as a text message sent to one of the president's family members in which Mark Meadows said he was pushing hard for Donald Trump to condemn this. Text messages reflecting Mr. Meadows' private skepticism about some of the wild public statements about allegations of widespread election fraud and compromised voting machines that were put forth by Sidney Powell. Sidney Powell is a lawyer working with Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. The committee also said it had a number of questions prompted by Mr. Meadows' new book, The Chief's Chief, and cited it as evidence that his refusal to testify was untenable. Mr. Meadows has shown his willingness to talk about issues related to the Select Committee's investigation across a variety of media platforms, anywhere it seems, except to the Select Committee, the panel wrote. The House Committee said it also had questions about why Mr. Meadows had used a personal cell phone, a Signal account, and two personal Gmail accounts to conduct official business, and whether he had properly turned over all records from those accounts to the National Archives. The report comes as the committee is scrutinizing a 38-page PowerPoint document containing plans to overturn Joe Biden's election victory. That document, which Mark Meadows provided to the committee, urged Donald Trump to declare a national emergency, to cling to power, and included an unsupported claim that China and Venezuela had obtained control over the voting infrastructure in a majority of U.S. states. Mark Meadows' lawyer has said he provided the document to the committee because he had received it by email and did nothing with it. Phil Waldron, a retired Army colonel who has promoted false claims of election fraud, said that he had circulated the document among Donald Trump's allies and among lawmakers on Capitol Hill in the days just before the mob violence on 6th of January. Rudolph Giuliani has identified Mr. Waldron as a source of information for his legal campaign. Phil Waldron told the Washington Post that he had visited the White House several times after last year's election and spoken with Mark Meadows maybe 8 to 10 times.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. When it comes to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, people usually talk about the crimes the regime has committed in this land. But Israel couldn't destroy the Palestinian people's homeland if it didn't have the support of Britain. The sad story of the occupation and its concomitant sufferings dates back to over 100 years ago. In 1916, once Britain's Prime Minister, then the Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, promised Palestine to the Jewish community in Britain. Then, on November 2nd, 1917, he made it official
in the form of a letter addressed to the leader of the Jewish community and a member of the Zionist movement in Britain, Walter Rothschild. At the time, Britain was not even in control of Palestine, as it was still part of the Ottoman Empire. Either way, Palestine was never Balfour's to transfer so casually to anyone else. The letter, known as the Balfour Declaration, marked the beginning of the occupation of Palestine.
And a group of Zionists met in London in 1917 on July the 17th to draft the formula for a declaration to be made by the British government that would, in fact, provide the underpinnings and the justification for Jewish immigration to Palestine and the creation of a national homeland. And so on July 17th, the Zionist organization completed work that it had been working on for a long time and drafted a declaration which was to be forwarded on to the British government. The British government then spent 4 or 5 months debating the formula for the declaration, slightly adjusted it, and issued it at the beginning of November in 1917.
When the intentions of the British and their rapport with the Zionists became too apparent, Palestinians started to protest, a kind that has never ceased, over a century later. The reason is, of course, too apparent, since the horrific consequences of British colonialism and the eventual complete Zionist takeover of Palestine are still felt after all these years. Paltry attempts to pacify Palestinian anger were to no avail, especially after the League of Nations Council in July 1922 approved the terms of the British Mandate for Palestine. It came without consulting the Palestinians, who would disappear from the British and international radar only to reappear as negligible rioters, troublemakers, and obstacles to the joint British-Zionist colonial concoctions. Despite occasional assurances, the British intention of ensuring the establishment of an exclusively Jewish state in Palestine was becoming clearer with time. The Balfour Declaration was hardly an aberration, but had indeed set the stage for the full-scale ethnic cleansing that followed decades later.
We are here in the neighborhood, the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in occupied East Jerusalem. We come here every week and to say no to the occupation, no to apartheid, no to ethnic cleansing. The Israeli government is planning to deport the indigenous people, Palestinian people, from their home in order to evacuate it for settlers, for Jewish settlers, for colonialists.
After World War II, the UK appeared as less influential in the international arena compared to what it used to be. However, it continued to support Israel in every possible way. In November 1967, after the Six-Day War, Britain co-authored the UN Resolution 242, which could have led to a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. However, it did very little to insist on its implementation as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. While many might argue that Britain has been more vocal towards Israeli crimes against Palestinians, London has taken no real action to condemn Israel for the crimes it commits in the occupied territories. For example, Britain could have issued a symbolic apology in 2017 on the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. It could have been a moment of reckoning for Britain, but it was not. Instead, the government of then Prime Minister Theresa May celebrated the occasion with Israeli authorities. In the meantime, the British government continues to advocate for the so-called two-state solution, a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. But in reality, it's only protecting the interests of the Israelis.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, 3 years ago, on the 9th of November 2011, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Richmondshire, then Foreign Secretary, told this House, and I quote, "The United Kingdom judges that the Palestinian Authority largely fulfills criteria for United Nations membership, including statehood." And he added, and again I quote, "We reserve the right, we the United Kingdom, reserve the right to recognize a Palestinian state bilaterally at a moment of our choosing and when it can best help bring about peace." Mr. Deputy Speaker, that moment is now. I urge honourable members on all sides to support this amendment.
we want is to see an Israel that is at peace with its neighbors. And I should remind you that the policy of our government is for a two-state solution, which is what we want to achieve and hope to help to bring about in a modest and humble way.
In fact, every time Palestine was getting close to claiming its rights, the UK came forward and stalled the process. When asked for clarification on the question of Palestinian statehood, then UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab sent a letter to the Balfour Project reiterating an old position. The British government will recognize a Palestinian state at a time when it best serves the objective of peace.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting leaders on all sides in Israel, in the Palestinian territories, President Abbas, obviously Prime Minister Netanyahu, Foreign Minister Ashkenazi. And look, I'm here because we are a strong friend of Israel, but we also feel very strongly that we want to see a peaceful two-state solution. We've got the ceasefire. The question is now how we can build on that, bed that in, avoid any further escalations, and try and find a track towards a two-state solution.
In just another example, back in April 2021, UK opposed the ICC investigation, saying it does not accept that the ICC has jurisdiction in this instance, partly since Palestine is not a sovereign state. Needless to say, the two-state idea is completely rejected by Palestinians, since they know all too well that none of the Western countries that talk about such a solution are on their side. That said, the resistance movement insists, as the only viable solution, on a public referendum participated in only by those who have roots in the land. Britain still talks about the so-called solution, but in reality, Israel has already killed the idea, trying to become a full-blown apartheid regime with international blessing. The support that Israel gets from Britain is not limited to these policies. In December 2020, Britain and Israel signed a military cooperation agreement.
Battle-tested on civilian populations around the world. Today is specifically a Stop Arming Israel Day because our government licenses weapons to a regime which is occupying a people and is using those weapons against the people, as we've seen over the last year, against ordinary people marching for freedom in Gaza.
There are also huge arms deals between the two as well. The UK has bought £46 million worth of military equipment from Israeli arms firm Elbit in the past 4 years. British soldiers have also been stationed in Israel since day one of the occupation. They give the Israelis military advice and training. The ties between Britain and Israel are so tight that the UK can never have an impartial stance when it comes to the Palestine issue, no matter who occupies the number 10 in Downing Street. Yet this unholy alliance has been at the expense of the Palestinian people, who have been geographically fragmented between refugee camps, in the diaspora, militarily occupied, and treated as second-class citizens in a land their ancestors dwelt since time immemorial.
The U.S. is selling Saudi Arabia $650 million worth of missiles and providing $500 million worth of maintenance for U.S.-made aircraft, training, and other support for its military operations. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kerry Peterson-Smith Ryder. This article is published under the heading Saudi Arabia Arms Sales is one of Biden's many militaristic actions in first year. Stay tuned for more. Given the brutish approach of his predecessor, many expected President Joe Biden to shift away from the worst practices in U.S. foreign policy and at the border in the previous 4 years. Indeed, in the first weeks of his presidency, the Biden administration signaled changes. In Secretary of State Antony Blinken's first press briefing, the State Department announced that it was reviewing weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which have led the catastrophic war in Yemen with essential U.S. partnership. A week later, Biden declared in his first foreign policy address as president that we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Regarding his practices at the border, Biden administration officials promised a shift away from Trump's practices of separating families and caging children, calling them a moral failing. He said that the new White House would deal with immigration comprehensively, fairly, and humanely. As 2021 comes to a close, however, we are seeing the latter part of the trajectory that settles into familiar, disastrous militarism. The United States is selling Saudi Arabia $650 million worth of missiles and providing $500 million worth of maintenance for U.S.-made aircraft, training, and other support for its military operations. These arrangements come as Saudi Arabia is escalating its devastating bombing in Yemen. In November, Saudi forces carried out the largest number of airstrikes since Trump's last year in office. These bookends, Biden's early announcement of an end to U.S. support for the war in Yemen and his subsequent robust material support of that war, capture the set of practices that the Biden White House is settling into, not only in Yemen, but also in the realm of war and imperialism more broadly. Consider the White House's approval of a $23 billion weapons sales to the UAE, which provides the Emirates with attack drones and F-35 fighter jets. The arrangement was negotiated under the Trump administration as the prize for the UAE's role in leading the normalization of diplomatic relations between the Zionist regime and itself, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, despite the Zionist regime's deepening violence against Palestinians. The Biden administration embraced the normalization agreements along with Trump's other actions meant to consolidate U.S. support and extend legitimacy to the Zionist regime in a time when Palestinian protest presents a steady challenge to the Israeli apartheid and global Palestine solidarity campaigns have gained more traction than ever. Trump fulfilled long-standing wishes of the Israeli regime right wing, including moving the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds from Tel Aviv, declaring the legality of the Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian West Bank, which are considered unambiguously illegal according to international law, and endorsing the Zionist regime occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights. Yet, when it comes to concrete action, Biden has accepted and continued along his predecessor's path. This continuity is also painfully evident regarding Biden's actions toward migrants, many of whom have been displaced due to U.S. imperialist policies. For example, in the face of severe social, political, and economic crises in Central America, which are driven by decades of Washington-directed economic policies and brutal repression carried out by U.S. armed regimes in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, Kamala Harris in Guatemala City, on her first overseas tour as vice president, presented the U.S. foreign policy in cruelty do not come.
Well,
Once they approach or enter the country, migrants face a complex of forces that remains in place to detain, incarcerate, and deport migrants and prevent their entry to the United States. Biden has maintained the use of Title 42, a statute that allows the federal government special powers in public health emergencies to deny migrants, including asylum seekers, access at the U.S.-Mexico border in violation of international law. Biden is thus continuing Trump's use of the measure, which was invoked when the COVID-19 pandemic began. Public health professionals and scholars have argued that the measure cannot be justified in the name of public health and have called upon the administration to end it. Biden has also reopened some of the most notorious detention sites highlighted in the Trump era, including Florida's Homestead Shelter for Unaccompanied Children. The numbers of people in detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, have swelled to 22,000 under Biden, marking a 56% increase since the day the new president took office. Biden's most dramatic and revealing act at the border this year was his handling of the arrival of thousands of primarily Haitian asylum seekers at Del Rio, Texas, in September. From Border Patrol agents on horseback whipping the black migrants to their confinement in squalid conditions on riverbanks and under a bridge, the U.S. government and its police forces engaged in racist violence, treating the Haitians as a criminal threat to its contained rather than vulnerable people with the right to seek refuge and asylum. Biden deported the groups of thousands to Haiti in an operation that revealed the logistical capacity at his disposal, which could, of course, instead be used to welcome people and support their survival. Finally, the Biden administration has resumed Trump's infamous Remain in Mexico policy, which forces people seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border to apply in Mexico and wait there while their applications are processed. The policy goes against the U.S. law, which guarantees people the right to apply for asylum inside the U.S., regardless of how they entered. Biden initially opposed the program, suspending it in February. In the face of rulings by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, however, the White House negotiated a new version of the policy with the Mexican government and has begun to administer it. The program, which made tens of thousands of asylum seekers vulnerable to kidnapping, assault, and other hazards in Mexico under Trump, is now Biden's. At the moment, Afghanistan faces mass hunger and an economic catastrophe as billions of dollars belonging to the Afghan Central Bank sit in the United States, frozen by order of Biden administration. Yet amid these blatant continuations of state violence, grassroots pressure has clearly made an impact. Biden's rhetorical vows to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen, for example, MTS Day War were responses, in significant part, to a years-long, consistent and vocal challenge of U.S. support for the war.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Again, we are here to present with another episode of A Muslim Lady, where we have been discussing so many important issues regarding Muslim lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in the studios, my wife, Razia Batul Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm just thanking Allah tabarak wa ta'ala to having this great opportunity. It's a biggest way of worshipping Allah. Thank you so much.
So, inshallah, today we are going to discuss about a very important and interesting topic, you know, which is the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Ali. Yeah, you know, this great man, how much changes he has brought in our society, in Muslim society. And one of it is regarding our Muslim lady.
Yeah, the moment you said Imam Khomeini, everyone knows about his revolution about this country, Iran. But I usually say the revolution was from inside the human kind throughout the world. And especially he was a big blessing of Allah for us as a Muslim practicing ladies. Until now, I'm just thanking Allah that Allah has given me life, and my life was in this era, in this time, because the freedom, the respect, the rights, which as a Muslim lady, I myself have experienced because of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. I don't think so I would have that many blessings in other times.
Yeah, especially from the West, they were thinking that Islam does not care about the rights of women, yeah? Because of so many Muslim, so-called Muslim countries, because we, even nowadays, we see that no any right of Muslim ladies or our women is taken care of. So somehow he has given a very good practical answer to the criticism of, you know, Western societies. That so Islam is, limits, you know, Islam, if you accept Islam, it means you are limited. You can't do social activities, you can't play any role in your society. So by bringing revolution in this part of the world and giving freedom to Muslim ladies, he has answered them, you know, practically answered them, and he has shut their mouths closed, you know, beautifully. So look at this, you know, modern Islamic Republic of Iran, where women play role shoulder by shoulder to gents and males.
No doubt, no doubt.
And having their own hijab, having their own chastity, modesty. So this is the true Islam. So all this credit goes to the great personality of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala. Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.